Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Hello. We're continuing our study in Joseph. It's unfortunate we had to break chapters 46 and 47, for they're obviously related, as really this whole account is. It's just hard to break it up in bite-sized units to talk about it. In 46, Joseph and his brothers talked about this impending visit to Pharaoh. It was obviously a welcoming visit. It was obviously in honor of who Joseph was. But it was some very important things to be dealt with about where they would live and why they were there. And Joseph had kind of tutored them on what they should say. So picking up in chapter 47, we find the actual occurrence of this special audience of the king. Then Joseph went in and told Pharaoh and said, "My father and my brothers and their flocks and their herds and all that they have come out of the land of Canaan, and behold, they are in the land of Goshen." Now, the land of Goshen is a very beautiful place. It's still very heavily populated, even in modern Egypt. If you take a map of Egypt and look at the Nile River Delta, it's on the eastern side of the Nile River Delta. It was known as a pasture land. Apparently, even Pharaoh had his flocks there. And apparently shepherds were somewhat ostracized in the Egyptian society as they would be later in rabbinical society. Now, it's called the best of the land in verses 6 and 7. It's also called the land of Ramses in verse 11. Now, many have wondered about that, but I think I'll wait to discuss that till I get to chapter 11. It's obviously a very good pasture land, this southern delta region. And he took five men from among his brothers and presented them to Pharaoh. The question has been asked, and I think rightly so, why just five of the 12 brothers? I get kind of tickled at the rabbis. I enjoy reading them, particularly Rashi. And Rashi quotes some of his predecessors that say that Joseph was to pick the weakest of his brothers, those who were the ugliest, lest Pharaoh draft all these men for his army. Well, I think that's a bit much. I really think there must be some kind of connection with the number five in Egyptian society. It's not by accident how often this word occurs in this Egyptian setting. You might want to notice the word five occurs in Genesis 41:34, 43:34, and 45:22, as well as here in chapter 47. It must have been some kind of special symbolic number to the Egyptians. Now, exactly what it is, I'm not sure. But even when the taxation is going to occur in this chapter, it's one-fifth. So I think we ought to go back and look in Egypt. We don't have a lot of documentation about the special use of numbers, but it seems that something like that is happening here. Some say he took the brothers that talked the least so they wouldn't stick their foot in their mouth. That may be true. Then Pharaoh said to his brothers, "What is your occupation?" They've been well-versed by Joseph in what to say. So he said to Pharaoh, "Your servants are shepherds, both we and our fathers." Now, I think there's two very significant reasons for this. Number one was that that's what they were. And he mentions here, we're not new at this. It's been our family trade for years. It also was something that would not threaten the Egyptians in any way. Matter of fact, quite the opposite. We learn that shepherds were ostracized in this society, as well as were foreigners. So as we see from Genesis chapter 38, the Canaanite society was affecting even men like Judah. And so in Egyptian society that somewhat had this aristocratic tendency anyway, and then the further it by the fact of their occupation, would pretty much culturally isolate the people of God. And they could develop their own sense of tribal and national identity even while in the land of Egypt sojourning. So I think that's probably the reason that Joseph continued to encourage them to tell Pharaoh that, so he wouldn't give them any other occupation, even as something meant to be beneficial. And they said to Pharaoh, "We have come to sojourn in the land, for there is no pasture for your servants' flocks, for the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. Now, therefore, please let your servants live in the land of Goshen." Well, I have isolated four things that I think they did to try to make Pharaoh feel better about this large group of people coming. That wasn't really large at this point. It will be later on, but it's still 70-plus individuals we know. They were shepherds, therefore they would live in a certain part of the land. They were sojourners. That means they weren't permanent residents, either of Canaan or Egypt, and they would be leaving at some time. Number three, they were forced into Egypt by the famine. They didn't want to come and looking for more land or better pastures. They were forced to by the climactic conditions. And number four, they ask in a very polite way, please may we live in the land of Goshen, which shows they're not pushy, they're requesting. I think all four of those things were meant to kind of alleviate any fears that Pharaoh may have. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, your father and your brothers have come to you. Now, the reason that Pharaoh addresses Joseph is either because he couldn't speak Hebrew, Joseph could speak Egyptian, or maybe it was a custom that that the king didn't speak to foreigners directly, but through an intermediary, whatever, we're just not certain. But he speaks to Joseph. And he says, the land of Egypt is at your disposal. Now, basically means before you. Implication is, choose where you want to have them stay. It's a very gracious offer. Settle your father and your brothers in the best of the land, which seems to be another name for the land of Goshen, as the land flowing with milk and honey is another name for Canaan or Palestine. Okay. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, then in verse 6, let them live in the land of Goshen. If you know any capable men among them, put them in charge of my flocks. Now, several things there. Number one, that shows that also Pharaoh had flocks in this area, so it was well known for its livestock. Secondly, it may have been a way that just Pharaoh was trying to show them extra kindness and saying, now, some of your brothers are real good, I'll give them a job with the royal flocks. Or it may have been a way, since Pharaoh knew how wonderful Joseph was for the blessings of God that rested on him, it may have been rather a selfish thing, like Potiphar did back in 39:5. He just wanted more of these sons of Jacob to help his flocks increase, as Joseph has obviously done to the rest of Pharaoh's property. There's no way to look at the psychological motives in the Bible, so we're not sure which it is. And Pharaoh addresses Jacob now directly. How many years have you lived? And Jacob said to Pharaoh, the years of my sojourn, by the way, look at verse 7. I skipped one. It's important. Presented him to Pharaoh, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh. There's been much discussion there about this. Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Here's Pharaoh and all his power and all his culture and all his sophistication. And here's this shepherding man that blesses him. Some say, well, it's just a normal blessing that everybody would give to a king like that. And, you know, I'm not so sure, because it's going to be mentioned down here again in verse 10. It seems there's an allusion to this in Hebrews chapter 7, verse 7. It shows something of a stature of Jacob that he would feel comfortable blessing Pharaoh. I mean, it does seem a bit out of order, wouldn't you say? So Pharaoh dialogues with him a minute. How old are you? And Jacob says to Pharaoh, the years of my sojourn are 130. Now, it's going to mention here his age. It's going to mention in chapter 48 when he dies. And these different mentioning through Genesis of these ages has helped us kind of correlate how these different times occurred as far as these patriarchs' ages. Now, notice what he says here. Few and unpleasant have been the years of my life, nor have they attained the years that my fathers lived during the days of their sojourning. Now, several things here. It's obvious he's saying that my family has been rather nomadic. He's also saying my life has not been real easy. And just think back over Jacob's life. He did have a lot of tension. Most of it he brought on himself, but he still didn't have an easy life. And he kind of reflects on that year. He had a hard life. And he either did not reach the level of prosperity of his fathers, or he's expecting to die and it thinks he'll not reach their age, and which it is, I'm not sure. But it shows something of Jacob's psychological feelings. Now, he was so down because Joseph had died. But now Joseph, he'd been reunited with Joseph, and he still got this kind of negative attitude. And notice that in verse 10 it says, and Jacob blessed Joseph and went out from his presence. I get so tickled at Martin Luther here. Martin Luther said that by blessing Pharaoh, that he really preached the gospel to Pharaoh and brought Pharaoh and his whole court into the worship of Yahweh. And he bases that on Psalms 105:22. I think that's a bit much. But you wonder how much these men of faith were sharing with their neighbors. I'm sure that Joseph had talked to Pharaoh as much as he could about his own God. There's a servant in Joseph's house that knows a lot about Joseph's God. Maybe Jacob did sense a evangelistic mission. Of course, he was certainly given that by God, and maybe that's true, but I think Martin Luther goes a bit far here. I sure hope Martin Luther's right. So Joseph settled his father and his brothers and gave them possession the land of Egypt and the best of the land of Ramses. Now from Exodus chapter 1 verse 11, Ramses is going to be one of the store cities that the Hebrews are going to have to build in their forced labor to a Pharaoh who knew not Joseph. And since we feel like that Ramses II is probably the Pharaoh of the oppression, then that kind of fits. Pharaoh of the Exodus, excuse me. I personally believe in this date of around 1290 B.C. that would fit the life of Ramses II. And so this would be a later name written back into the account earlier. And we do that a lot of times. It's just, it doesn't mean that it's a later author in the sense that's later than Moses. It's just something Moses might have done because of the importance of the name Ramses. Some say the king got his name from this area, but the town got its name from the area and the king got his name from the town. We just don't know. I think for the archaeological evidence of the cities destroyed in the land of Canaan, about 40 years after this 1290 date, which would be about 1250, and because of the mention of Ramses here, I feel much more comfortable with 1290 B.C. as the date for the Exodus, instead of the more traditional 1445, which seems to fit some of the dates of the Bible itself. We just really don't know at this point. And I guess it doesn't make a whole lot of difference, really, does it? God still split the Red Sea, no matter what day it was. Now notice that it mentions here then in verse 12, and Joseph provided his fathers and his brothers and all the father's household with food according to their little ones. There's been two possible meanings of this term little ones. It sounds kind of redundant there. Either Joseph allotted food according to the number of individuals that needed it, which meant that all their little ones got an allotment of food. Now, the rabbis say that children waste their bread, and so it means that Joseph gave them extra abundant supplies. Even the kids could waste the bread. I don't know. I'm sure he did give them all they needed. Some say that the term little ones, it may be a technical term for the covenant people. Now, I think there's some technical evidence for that, but I don't think it's real obvious, and so I'm not sure which it is. The individual allotment seems the best option for me. Now, there was no food in all the land because the famine was severe, so that the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished under the famine. It hit this whole region, as it usually does, in cyclical patterns. And Joseph gathered all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan. This shows he was selling grain to the surrounding nations also, like he did to Jacob and his own family. Which they bought, and Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. So all the economic coinage or weightage of money, all the things they used for money like clothing and all that was taken into Pharaoh's treasury. And when the money was all spent in the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, "Give us food, for why should we die in your presence, for our money is gone." Now some have really gotten really uptight with Joseph, saying he's just gouging these people and exploiting them. We're not sure of all that was involved, but apparently it was the plan that all the property come into the possession of the state. And this was the plan they used. So Joseph says, "Give me your livestock, and I will give you food for your livestock since your money is gone." Now, this really isn't all that cruel. The truth is, these people couldn't feed their cattle, and they were going to die anyway. Joseph is going to keep them alive by feeding them for the state. And so they bring their cattle, and Joseph feeds them. Now, some say, well, why don't they just eat their cattle? So they could eat meat instead of grain. Well, the truth is, the Egyptians were real nervous about eating cattle because it was one of their gods, and several of their animals were gods. And so, kind of like the modern Hindus would be nervous about doing that. The Egyptians apparently were. So he brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them food in exchange for horses and flocks and herds and donkeys, and fed them with the food in exchange for all the livestock that year. This apparently is the sixth year of the seven-year famine. And when that year was ended, they came to him the next year and said, "We will not hide from my lord that our money is all spent. Our cattle are my lord's. There is nothing left for my lord except our bodies and our lands." And Joseph says, okay, and that's what we want to do. We want to start a serf system in Egypt, and the historical documents are very clear. This did happen. The Pharaoh theologically owned all the land, but now it came into actual reality. So they become serfs of Pharaoh. The land reverts to the state. And we're going to realize there's an exception with the priests, but most of the land, there was no private ownership. And it may be that the Hebrews mentioned this, particularly Moses, because that was different from what they were used to traditionally. They had some land they bought. Of course, they were sojourners too and would identify with this. Now, Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for food, and we and our land will be slaves to Pharaoh. So give us seed that we may live and not die, that the land may not be desolate. They're kind of saying, if we die, it'll just be desert. You might as well use us. So Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh. And the word here for land is the word Adamah. It means productive soil. In the same end of this verse, it says, thus the land became Pharaoh. It's the term Eretz, which means the whole territory. Play on words you don't see, particularly in Egypt. Now, it mentions here that Joseph bought all this for Pharaoh. His title, the title of Joseph mentioned earlier in Genesis 41:40 and 45:8, literally means someone who was the property manager for Pharaoh. Now, he was administrator of all the land of Egypt, but uniquely the property manager of Pharaoh. I think he did a pretty good job, don't you? Pharaoh owned everything. And so this title, it really fits what Joseph is doing right now. So the Egyptian sold his field, every Egyptian sold his field because the famine was severe upon them, and the land thus became Pharaoh's. And as for the people, he removed them from their cities from one of Egypt's border to the other. This has caused a lot of problems. Why would he want to remove them from the country to the cities? Well, some say it was to make the distribution of food easier because they couldn't grow anything on their lands anyway. It was still in the famine years. So he just brought everybody from the country into the city to make it easier to distribute food. That's a real possibility. But you know, the Septuagint and the Samaritan Pentateuch, which is Hebrew, of course, Septuagint being Greek, says he made slaves of them. And that is followed by the Revised Standard Version of the Bible. That seems to fit the context of verse 19 and 25, where they offer to be slaves, and verse 23, where he gives them seed to plant in another year. So slaves seem to fit better in the context than a radical relocation project, but we just can't be 100% sure. Look at verse 22. This is a little historical tidbit, but it seems to so show the historicity of this Egyptian account. Only the land of the priest he did not buy, for the priest had an allotment from Pharaoh, and they lived off the allotment which Pharaoh gave them. Therefore, they did not sell their land. We know from several of the historians, both Roman and Greek, that the Egyptian the Egyptian populace did not own land, but the priest and the warriors and the royal house did. And that seems to fit this historical example, although we have no Egyptian documents that talk about the buying of the land of Pharaoh. Thus Joseph said to all the people, behold, I today have bought you and your land for Pharaoh now. Here is the seed for you that you may sow the land. Now the rabbis say in verses, particularly back to 21 and 23, that he made them move from their land to the city as a demonstration that they didn't own the land anymore. He wouldn't let them live on their ancient tribal or ancient family land as a sign they really had sold their land. I don't know if that's true or not. It's a possibility. Now at the harvest, you shall give one-fifth to Pharaoh. Four-fifths shall be your own for seed and of the field and for your food and for those of your household and food for your little ones. Now, you may think that 20% tax is tough. But boy, I want to tell you, from the Code of Hammurabi and some other documents, that was not very high at all, really. There were some very exploitive amounts in Babylon and Mesopotamia we know about. Now, this idea of becoming serfs, was this common in the ancient world? Well, it's interesting, again, that from the Code of Hammurabi, it does talk about some laws related to serfs. Also, in the Nuzi tablets, we find, and our archaeological discovery at Ugarit, we have found a mention of serfs. So it was not culturally unusual. This seems to fit in the pattern of the day. And Joseph made it a statute concerning the land of Egypt, valid to this day. Verse 26 shows the hand of a later author, which I, of course, think is Moses. And Pharaoh should have a fifth. Now, there's the magic number five here again, as we saw so often, apparently a very significant number in Egypt. And only the land of the priests did not become Pharaoh's, probably because they were a pretty powerful group. You don't want to mess with them. Now, Israel lived in the land of Egypt, Israel meaning Jacob, in the land of Goshen, and they acquired property. Probably they had some money, and they bought some land, as well as sojourn there, we're not sure, and were fruitful and became very numerous. I guess they did. They came with 70 individuals. Now, that didn't include probably slaves and helpers, but 70 adults into the land. And they're going to go out somewhere around, we're not sure if it's 600,000 to 2.5 million. But folks, boy, that's some proliferation, isn't it? Now notice, if you would, where it mentions then, let's see. Verse 28. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the length of Jacob's life was 147 years. Now this again is, I think, very interesting. It mentions, you can see the different places he lived. He lived in Mesopotamia for a while. He lived in Paddan Aram. He lived in Canaan. Now he's going to live in Egypt. Jacob really lived in a lot of different places. He really was a sojourner in the truest sense of the word. Not just a nomadic moving his flocks from here to there, but really traveling to several different countries. It's surprising to me, Jacob, like his father, thinks he's going to die pretty early. And he lived quite a long time after that. So he lived 17 years in Egypt. Let's see now. By the way, he lived 147 years. Remember earlier he said to Pharaoh that my days aren't as many as my father's? Of course, they lived much longer than this. I think 175 and 180 years, if my memory serves me. So he didn't live quite as long as Abraham and Isaac. And he made allusion to that. When the time came for Israel to die, he drew near and called his son Joseph and said to him, "Please, if I have found favor in your sight," this is kind of a polite way, it's just an idiom, "place your hand under my thigh." That's interesting. Why would that be? Well, it seems to be a cultural idiom for an oath. Now, you might go back to Genesis 24:2, where Abraham's servant had to do this. Now, placing it under the thigh or under the loin may have been some way to swear by a man's descendants or a man's seed. Exactly how that worked itself out, we're not sure, but it was the covenant promise of God to multiply the seed, and somehow it'd be like us putting a hand on the Bible. That was the kind of form of this oath. And boy, Jacob was serious. He didn't want just a promise. He wanted him to swear, make an oath by God and his promised descendants, apparently. Some say an oath by the Messiah. I think that's a bit much. But it is by God's covenant promises. "And deal with me in hesed," because this is a very important word used for covenant loyalty, and it fits here, "and faithfulness." And I think that's another one of those word for truth, but truth in the Old Testament, there's a word for faithfulness and trustworthiness and a different word for trust or truth. So this is the word for faithfulness. "Please do not bury me in the land of Egypt." Now there is some implications here. Notice in verse 30 it says, "When I lie down, my fathers, you shall carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burial place." Now, it's obvious that Jacob is going to face death with a great sense of trust. It's not fear. He just wants to know where he's going to be buried. Now, the implication here, they're not going to stay in the land of Egypt. That Egypt is a temporary thing. Now, we know that's true. Now, whether Jacob knew that from talking to his daddy, who was told by his daddy about the revelation of God in Genesis 15:16, I'm not sure. But years ago, God had told Abraham that his descendants would go to Egypt and they'd be enslaved there, but God would bring them out. So this is an allusion to the Exodus. It's also an allusion to the thought of an afterlife. He wanted to be with his fathers in death. The normal Hebrew idiom here is he slept with his fathers. Sleep, of course, is an Old Testament idiom for death. But the idea is they're still alive, they still exist, they'd be in Sheol. I don't think they had a detailed understanding of the afterlife, but here is a man full of years, confident that death is not the end of conscious life, and that he would be with his family. Well, I think that's helpful to us. I think that's good. And then he said, "Swear to me," in verse 31. Boy, Jacob wanted to make sure his bones weren't going to stay in Egypt. He wanted to be in the promised land. And even today, I get so tickled at Jews, they all want to be buried on the Mount of Olives because they believe that they'll be the first to be resurrected. Well, the tombs there are getting on top of each other. So many folks want to be buried there. Jacob wanted to go back to Israel, the land of promise. "And he swore to him. Then Israel bowed in worship at the head of his bed." Oh, what a confusing thing. You get a picture of this guy in bed kneeling toward the head of the bed. Well, that doesn't make sense. There's been many emendations and suggestions here. I think the best is that it, instead of the head of the bed, should probably be the head of the staff. Now, that's what the Septuagint has, which is, of course, the Greek translation around 250 B.C. And it is quoted in Hebrews 11:21 as the head of the staff. It was either Jacob's reverence for Joseph's authority, where he would touch the top of Jacob's staff with his forehead, and the staff being a symbol of a ruler. Now, this may have been Jacob's way and his dying moment of fulfilling Joseph's dream back in Genesis 37. Remember, it wasn't only his brothers that bowed down to Joseph, but it was his father and mother. And the mother was dead. But here is Jacob maybe fulfilling that prophecy late in his life. Maybe, I'm not sure. Maybe it was Jacob recognizing Joseph's preeminence and authority. Maybe it's Jacob realizing that Yahweh was working through Joseph in a marvelous way to protect and extend the covenant people. Jacob some way makes an act of reverence toward his son, and apparently it's in the context of the covenant God. More than that, I don't really know. I know that this touching the forehead to the staff was a sign of a symbol in Egypt of recognizing authority, and something of that is caught up here. Well, that basically is the end of Genesis 47, and we'll do 48 and 49 together next time. I think it's interesting here. We see how this story is held together so well. The different elements of the plot have all worked together. Surprising things have happened as God's sovereignty has been seen versus man's resources. And so I think there are many wonderful, beautiful applications, maybe not the least of which is this great faith in the time of death. New Testament calls death a friend to us. Jesus has pulled the stinger out of death. We need not fear. God is for us. What better can we have? Well, I've really enjoyed being with you, and I hope to see you again. Same time, same place next week. Please pray for us as we do these lessons.